wish I was a mole in the ground.
First Nations and our people that have been living here for thousands of years.
Tots may we. Good morning. That was a mashup of the Old Mole song and Taboo singing Stand Up for Standing Rock. This is KBOO Radio, and this is Nimi Poo Mole, Julian Ankeny, coming to you from the Lapway, Idaho, on the Nez Perce Nimi Poo Indian Reservation. I'll be your host for today's Old Mole Variety. This morning, we'll bring you audio excerpts from the April 21st and 22nd WSU, that is Washington State University, conference on Native Sovereignty, Decolonization, Divestment, Reparations, and Environmental Justice, Constructing Coalitions at the Intersections, sponsored by Washington State University Vancouver Native Programs and the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice. And in between segments, we'll be playing music from an all-Native lineup of artists. Today's show features the following segments. Remembering Salmon Scam. In a continuation of the fish wars of the 1960s and 70s, a 1982 federal sting operation scapegoated and criminalized Columbia fisher people for diminishing salmon runs. Wenampum fishing rights activist David So Happy Sr., his son David Jr., Bruce Jim, enrolled Warm Springs, and Wilbur Schlockish Jr., the hereditary chief of the Klickitat, were convicted in court, in a federal court, and spent years in prison for exercising treaty-protected rights to fish in their usual and accustomed places. The panel, facilitated by Salalawayam activist Lana Jack, features commentary from some of the defendants, along with defense attorney Tom Keefe. Then we'll hear excerpts from a panel on Black Indigenous Solidarity, featuring Kent Ford, co-founder of the Portland chapter of the Black Panthers, activist scholar Sky Wilson, and Danica Brown, enrolled Choctaw of the Wantanlak Oshi White Crane Clan. They discuss solidarity and intersecting struggles against racism, colonization, and police violence, from AIM and the Black Panthers to Standing Rock and the George Floyd uprising. And finally, Lana Jack reads from her short memoir, We Are Here, Mourning, Resilient, and Resistance, the story of the Salilawayam, which appears in the spring edition of the Oregon Historical Quarterly. Jack recounts stories of growing up fishing with her father and sisters on the Columbia River and speaks to the stakes in the Salilawayam struggle for federal recognition. First up, Salmon Scam. The segment begins with defense attorney Tom Keefe.
A little over 35 years ago, I had the opportunity to represent David So Happy Sr. and Jr., Wilbur Schlockish, Leroy Yocash, and Matt McConville in the tribal court retrial of the Salmon Scam. And it's a real privilege today to be listening to Bruce Jim, because I never got a chance to meet him. Our paths have never crossed, so it's really nice to be with him today and to listen to the great wisdom that Lana and her sister have about the real world implications of trying to live on the river and trying to keep lifestyles going in the face of what we on the other side of the river call progress. Had a hard time looking back on that tribal court salmon scam era because of all the pain that was inflicted on river people. The So Happy family are members of the Wanapum Band of Columbia River Indians. The Wanapums never signed a treaty, but they've had a huge impact on the history of Indian people in the Pacific Northwest. So Happy v. Smith was an enormously important case that opened the door for the Bolt decision, which reaffirmed the rights of the tribal fishermen to have 50% of the harvest. So the name So Happy has been ringing through the corridors of power, both here and in Washington, D.C., ever since 1968, when that court decision was handed down. David So Happy was an old-time Indian, nothing more and nothing less. He knew who he was. He knew why he was here. He said, my life is for the salmon. And when my work is done, I will move on. But there's a reason why 13 carloads of heavily armed federal and state agents came down to that little camp in June of 1981, kicked the door in at the So Happy's house, held Myra So Happy at the point of a gun while she dressed, and ransacked the house. And it had a lot to do with the history of the state of Washington. And I was born and raised in the state of Washington. And I remember the fish wars. I went to a small college just up the hill from a place called Frank's Landing, and you could almost smell the tear gas wafting up from that river. Cook's Landing and Frank's Landing were two of the epicenters of the Indian fishing rights dispute in the Pacific Northwest. And I think it's really ironic and interesting that Billy Frank, an Esquali Indian from Frank's Landing, who was the best man at my wedding and became a very close friend, he talked me into representing David and these other fellows in tribal court. He is about to be enshrined in the U.S. Capitol, a statue of him as one of the two statues representing our state. When I knew Billy, any politician who saw him coming down the hall would run in the other direction just to get away from him. Because the fishing rights dispute that worked its way up to the Bolt decision only got more intense once the treaty rights were affirmed. And if you want to know why and what kind of climate it was, all you need to do is look at the Ninth Circuit Court decision as the treaty rights were on their way to the Supreme Court for the sixth time in that century. And what the court said was, what we're seeing in the Northwest is the most massive disobedience of federal law seen in this century, with the possible exception of certain busing cases in the South. And so that's the climate. I mean, people didn't just argue with each other. People pulled out guns and shot at Indian people who were trying to exercise their rights. And David and the other, Wilbur's father, Wilbur Slakish Sr. was our first witness in tribal court. I called him there because for a couple reasons. One is the Slakish name is the last name on the treaty of 1855. And Wilbur Jr. used to tell me it was because he was so reluctant to sign it. But Wilbur's father went off to war for this country. And when he came home, he took off his uniform and went down to the river to his scaffold to go fishing. And he got arrested. And that's the way it's been along the Columbia River. That's the way it's been during the, you know, since the dawn of statehood, suppressing, regulating, doing everything it could to keep Indians off the river was considered normal behavior. You know, you pull an Indian over with a tail light in his car and find some fish in his car, boom, off to jail he went for illegally fishing. It was really, it was a disgrace and an embarrassment to our state. And it's the darkest chapter in Washington state history. I think we need to keep that history alive, and we need to keep the spotlight on it. The treaties have been to the Supreme Court 8 times now. They went one more time under our current Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, who's a good guy. But policy in our state is driven by salmon steelhead user groups. You know, so whether it's the Department of Game or the Department of Fisheries, or they even now the National Marine Fisheries Service, those entities respond to the constituencies that they're there to serve. And they treat the resource like a pie eating contest. Each year they want to see how big of a slice each of the constituencies can get and how small of a slice they can keep the Indian people confined to. And it's just really ridiculous, particularly when you discover and learn, as I did, riding around the state of Washington in Billy Frank's old Chrysler, that the salmon isn't a lottery ticket. It isn't a toy. There's a spiritual quality about it. There's a reason why the creator sent the salmon back to the rivers for the Indian people who've lived there since time immemorial. That's why they have salmon feasts. That's why the people pray over it. I remember David telling me, if take the first salmon to the longhouse, you pray over it, and the creator will return it to you a thousandfold. That's what it was all about. And one of the great ironies of the salmon scam was the National Marine Fisheries Service responded to a request from the Washington State Department of Fisheries in the fall of 1981 to join with them and to go down and create an illegal fish buying operation. And their phase one was in that fall, and they just was basically a get acquainted session. Then they came again in the spring, and they suckered Bruce Jim into helping them out. And the phase three, they built a fish buying station at that sacred little village of Sulilo, because while nobody was looking, they'd snuck through a little amendment to a federal law called the Black Bass Lacey Act, and they created a dimension of it that had never existed before to allow federal court prosecution for violations of tribal law. Under the So Happy v. Smith decision, it would have been impossible that year to convict any of them in state court for a state court fishing violation. So one of the really real tragedies of that whole prosecution is that they ended up getting convicted in federal court of violating state law that they could not possibly have been convicted of in a state court prosecution. So, that's one of the problems with trying to figure out how to put somebody in jail and then starting a sting operation before you have the law. On the day of the raid on Cook's Landing, a press release was issued by the National Marine Fisheries Service talking about this dangerous poacher who was wasting all the salmon. After his conviction in federal court in Los Angeles, the federal government prosecutor jumped up and asked for that he immediately be put in jail because there was about to be an armed uprising at Cook's Landing. And one of the reporters that was listening went and called the sheriff of Skamania County and tried to check out, is the sheriff there? And the guy said, no, he's not here. He didn't come to work today. Oh, well, we heard there's going to be an uprising at Cook's Landing. And the guy that answered the phone said, gee, that's the first time I heard that. And so there was this constant, ongoing, orchestrated effort to paint David as the leader of a massive conspiracy. 106,000 pounds of fish. He was the ringleader of it. Bruce was, right up there with him.
Our treaty fishermen need to be exonerated. They were only exercising a right given by the creator himself since the first dawn. So at this time, I would like to introduce Bruce Jim.
Come from Columbia River, Sulilo. I come from a time of my grandfather's when there was abundance of salmon. Dry racks were full. Then came along the dam building days and the loss of village sites, burial grounds, access to fish. And sometimes you can't see these things unless you actually lived through it. To hear the promises of the U.S. presidents standing under the dams that they built to the chiefs of the Columbia River. Don't worry, you'll have more fish coming back. And I will always remember those words on March 10th. Sulilo flooded over. I was 13 years old at that time. I remember that day and how sick our old people got looking at this happening. It not only destroyed numerous villages, fishing sites, burial grounds, but most of all destroyed the spiritual strength of our people. This has, when you start putting what the government has done, and they, had eradication programs in places for their people to benefit from the buffalo, the wolves, the grizzly bears, coyotes, passenger prison and recently a lamprey. And I often think if the shoe was on the other foot, what and the tribes had that power, what would be thought and what would be done? You know, our people suffered a lot. And when you talk about the salmon scam and everything else, it was all about special interest groups having more time to fish, more time to catch salmon, in order to get more opportunity for the fishermen to fish, they had to kind of start blocking and attacking the treaty rights of the people of the Columbia River. When we start looking at the special interest groups and how this all evolved, you had Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, you had NOAA Fisheries, you had Oregon State Department of Fish and Game, you had Washington State Game, all get together and create an investigation, as they called salmon scam. Because somebody made a complaint of 25,000 fish that was missing. So we end up being investigated, and the tribal people that was investigated. You know, today there's only four or five of us left from that whole investigation. No matter what the tribal people try to bring up, that Judge Tanner would deny it. And we never understood his reasoning of why he was like that and why he treated us in such a way. But it was because the government entity wanted to have their case and make their case to weaken the tribal sovereignty and tribal fishing or treaty rights. We were taken to a federal court system and convicted by a law that wasn't even enacted yet. 30 days after our conviction, that law came into effect after our court case. In the Los Angeles Times, a week after we got out of court, a big writing in the paper, that 25,000 missing fish was found below John Day Dam.
Thank you, Bruce. Chief Wilbur Slokish.
I would like to really hope that you can understand some of these things. And when Bruce talked about the special interest groups, they tend to forget they only have a license privilege because they have to buy a license from the state. We don't, because we reserved and retained those food gathering rights. But yet, when that longest welfare line in history, the Oregon Trail, came here, you know, they came with nothing. And all they wanted was a little piece of land to grow a crop to feed their people. And now we have the little piece of land from a thing called Doctrine of Discovery, authorizing to do away with us. And I think the federal government's been trying to do that because they've been taking away a lot of our food source. These dams here down in this area here, I can only talk about Bonneville, John Day, and Adels, because that's what I know of. McNary and up there, that's a different area. I don't have the knowledge of that. But they came and destroyed spawning beds in these dams. A big one there at John Day, they flooded out the spawning beds. And then they turned around and claimed we're the ones that caused the missing salmon that were out there. That was not 25, but 40,000 fish. That's what they caused to start the investigation by Washington and Oregon, and insisting that the NOAA fisheries take away that. And then they didn't really come out and say what was causing those fish not to migrate up from Bonneville Dam to McNary Dam. But those aluminum plants were pouring fluorides into the river. And then they flooded the airways and the papers with propaganda that we were the ones that were making the fish decline. And when we went to the trial, Jack Tanner, the judge, he had always tell us when he'd recess, when he'd come out of there, and he'd say, "I know how to get you guys out of it, but I'm not going to tell you." Then he would laugh. He would laugh. He thought it was funny that they were prosecuting us. And we weren't tried as tribal citizens. We were tried as United States citizens. And when we managed these fisheries, there was millions of fish in this river, up to 30 million.
Thank you, Uncle.
Hello, my name's David Sohappy Jr. I've been on the trail with my father. I backed him up. We wanted to see you. All these words are passed down, father to son, all the unwritten laws. We catch our first salmon. We have a feast on it. We pray, you give thanks to the Tamanwitla, the creator. I've been doing that. I've been fishing since 1963, 60 years now. I've been fishing on this river, except 2 years when Jack Tanner threw me in jail, prison. He even threw us in prison because of rumors that we were Indians were buying guns up here. Went to Terminal Island, went to all the prisons in the West Coast, seems like hardened criminals. Told those guys what I was there for. They couldn't believe me. Said, "What's the government coming to? Were you fishing with fishing pole?" I said, "No." They were funny, you know. They were hardened criminals. They were there for bank robbery. And then Lompoc, they put me in a guy doing two life consecutive terms. A lot of these things coming to the salmon now in the ocean. Plastics, microplastics. That's bad for the fish. Cancer, causes cancer. The Indians eat that fish, probably eating cancer too. So, but you find bad things in a lot of foods you eat nowadays. Like you don't have to be embalmed anymore when you pass away. It's just a joke, inside joke. Indians were never embalmed. We go return to Mother Nature, the earth. I'll let my brother speak now. Andy, so happy.
Thank you. Hello, my name's Andy Sohappy. My Indian name is Shmuhala. I feel kind of strange talking to TV. Usually I'm yelling at it. So my version of the salmon scam started in like 1938 when they flooded out our fishing area at Juneau Lake. We're dependent on that fish like the air we breathe, and that's in United States versus Winings in 1902. So when they flooded out that dam and they promised us home, they wanted us out of the gorge.
Tots may we. Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. You just heard Taboo singing One World, and before that you heard segments from a panel on Salmon Scam, facilitated and organized by Lana Jack. Up next, excerpts from a panel on Black Indigenous Solidarity, facilitated by Washington State University Professor of African American Literature and Culture, Aaron O'Forley, and featuring Kent Ford, co-founder of the Portland Black Panthers, along with social activist and scholar Sky Wilson, and Danica Brown, enrolled Choctaw of the Watonalak Oshi Crane Clan.
First is Danica. Danica, take it away.
Halito Achichi Okshwuba, Hilili Fish, I'm Danica. I have a terrible head cold. It's just stuck right in my head. So, but I was born and raised in northern New Mexico, and my grandfather was a Watchus Standing Buffalo, and his Christian name was Little Joe Gomez. My father is Richard Brown. He's a man with the Native American Church. And so I grew up in the Native American Church. And my mother, who's Scottish, her family were members of the Communist Party in the 50s. And my great aunt Ola was a grand jury resister during 1958. So I come from a long line of resistors. So for me, when I ran away from home when I was 16 and moved to Denver, Colorado, and soon there I met up with Russell Means and got recruited into the American Indian Movement. And I was a member of the American Indian Movement until 2005 when I left, primarily because of the misogyny within our organization. But you know, at that time in Denver in the 90s, there was a lot of white supremacist organizing. There was, during the Martin Luther King Day, there was a group of from the Denver Skins who were a neo-Nazi skinhead group, Skin Street Gang. One of the leader of that organization, who was tied to Tom Messer's group, really wanted to kind of organize with the Ku Klux Klan and wanted to build ties between the white Aryan resistance and the Ku Klux Klan. There was a lot of bad blood between those two organizations. And so Sean Slater wanted to kind of build that. So his idea was to have on Martin Luther King Day, these rallies to talk about white supremacy. And at the time there wasn't really like anti-fascist organizing against those kinds of events. And so the American Indian Movement at the time, we got together with a number of other organizations to fight against that. And consequently, if you Google Denver riots of 1992, you'll see there were like these massive riots that happened. And for 3 years, Sean Slater was having his little rally where the police would come. And, you know, there would be like 50 of them Sig Heiling and doing their little, you know, wear their little hoods and running around and being protected by the police. And then these just massive riots would happen in reaction to it. And so for 3 years that happened, and it was the American Indian Movement that was really the kind of the leading organization fighting against those. But we were also working across different other organizations like Black-led organizations and Chicano-led organizations, and then our white allies were American Friends Service Committee. So for 3 years, we fought against that. And then finally, we realized, well, they're getting permits. So we ended up just getting the permits for Martin Luther King Day for the state capitol after that for 5 years, and they no longer had their little rally. But in that time, we were really like interested in working cross culturally and cross organizationally to, you know, defend our community against white supremacy. So I was doing a lot of studying and reading, and there was a number of study groups that we were doing, and really kind of leaning towards the work that the Black Panthers had done, in particular around studying and understanding colonialism and understanding imperialism in the United States and understanding our enemy. And that was, I think, one of the greatest lessons that I learned from the Black Panthers was that. And through that process, what I started to understand was how intimately tied our historic legacies are. This country was founded, and the capital that created this country came from the stealing of land from tribal people and the enslavement of Black people. And so although our experiences are not the same, they're intimately tied together. And so for me, I really wanted to understand what that looked like and started building collaborations across with Black organizers and studying with them and creating Black and Indigenous solidarity movements and organizations. And so when I moved to Portland, Oregon, at that time, too, I was also doing a lot of political prisoner support, primarily for Leonard Peltier. But then I became a member of Anarchist Black Cross. And Mr. Ford's son was also a political prisoner at that time. And I had started doing political prisoner support for his son. And then I moved to Portland. And so when I moved to Portland, I had a birthday party for Leonard Peltier. It was his 70th birthday. And Mr. Ford came to that event, and that's really where I got to know him and met him. And, you know, he shared a story. If you don't mind me sharing, Mr. Ford, I'll share this story. That when his son was put into prison, one of the first prisons he was put into was the same prison that Leonard was being housed at. And Leonard kind of took his son under his wing and took care of him. And that Mr. Ford felt like he had a great deal of gratitude towards Leonard for doing that and taking care of his son when he was in prison. So I kind of started hanging out with Mr. Ford and, you know, building a relationship with him. And then back after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson in the Mike Brown case, we started organizing in Portland. A number of different kind of anarchist and communist groups started organizing and working with the Albina Ministerial Alliance to organize some protests. When the Black Lives Matter started, there was a small group of young Black people in Portland that we started collaborating with, and we started an African Indigenous Solidarity Group. And we just started doing a study, a political study, getting together, reading Black and Indigenous political literature. Studying the Black Panthers, studying the American Indian movement, studying other resistance movements across the country, and developing solidarity and camaraderie across. I think some of the deepest political work I've ever done was sitting in a room with Indigenous and Black organizers from all over the country, eating food, drinking some wine, and talking politics. It's like the most powerful work I've ever done, better than getting arrested, but, you know, and building relationships with people like Mr. Ford, and every day I learn more and more from him.
Thank you, Danica. Mr. Kent, you are up now.
Thank everyone for having me and invite me. And Danica mentioned post George Floyd and during the George Floyd uprising. She didn't mention that, they raised all this money to bail people out of jail and mutual aid vans and printed pocket lawyers. And they were down every night. And the most beautiful thing was having a group of Native people that ran around across from the Justice Center, you know, beating their drums in a circle. It was really powerful. It just all came together. You know, night after night, I've never been so proud to be from Portland, Oregon in all my life. For 100 days, we sit not set the stage for America, but the world. We sustain and maintain the protest. 1966, a group of Marriott College students came up with a 10-point platform and program. And number 7, want to immediately end the police brutality and murder of Black people. That's more valid today than it was written back in 1966. Civil rights was a miserable failure. It got a few jobs for some people, but it never did filter down to the people that they're killing on the streets. And every year, you know, since they've been tracking these police murders in America, it's been 1,000, 1,100, 1,200. In the whole European Union, only 10 people got arrested by the police. I think we accomplished more post-George Floyd than civil rights accomplished in over 50 years. That's where the Black Panther got started at in Lowndes County, Alabama. And then the war in Vietnam came along, and we had the peace movement hooked up with the civil rights movement, and things evolved from that. I've been a student for a Democratic Society, the AIM guys, the Crusade for Justice, the Brothers and Sisters out of Colorado. Those were some powerful groups. And I tell people on a walking church, you know, we had to listen to James Baldwin, a study Baldwin, we studied Malcolm. You have a knife in somebody 9 inches, you pull it out 6 inches, that's not progress. Just pull it out all the way, take the struggle forward, you know, and you guys are professors and educators and scholars and researchers and everything. And I tell all the guys I meet, I love all you guys, but you have to learn it out here on the street. You're the revolutionary socialists, and we organize from the sidewalk down. How many ask everybody here, you know, the scholars, the researchers, the professors and everything, how many ask you to keep up your good work, stay in the fight? You know, it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. And I tell the guys, we used to say out on the streets, you know, you never cross over, you never go to the other side. You never kiss up to power. We should have these political education classes every Wednesday up at Martin Luther King School. And now it used to be Highland School, and it was the Highland neighborhood. And we had certain books we would read out of, and we have a reading list and everything. And 40 and 50 to 70 people would turn out every Wednesday. And that's where the party in Fulton formed out of. And this was in between the both assassination of Malcolm X and Dr. King. We just tried to reach out to the community. We had the clinics in, and the dental clinic, the health clinic, the breakfast program. The city had completely written off that area. And so we said, okay, fine. We had our own building. We had to run a program. We had our own program to be run out, 10-point platform and program out of. I came into the struggle via the peace movement, via the Vietnam War. And for some reason, when Muhammad Ali said, no Vietnamese ever called me that word, I took it to here, and then I took it to heart. Then I hit the streets with the Black Panther Party newspapers. When the paper came out every week, we did over 100,000 sickle cell tests. We seen hundreds of patients every week at the health clinic. And again, I want to say, when they come after you, you know you must be doing something right. And the people had our backs, we had theirs. And we started out at the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. We went into voters registration, dental care, health care, breakfast program, preschool, eliminate that preschool to prison pipeline. We want to keep it in the streets. We want to keep things moving, build on what we accomplished in the last several years. They're going to come after us. They're going to hit us with everything they got. But I feel we got some serious changes coming. So thank you for having me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Poore. Okay, Dr. Sky Wilson.
Thank you. And I first want to register that it's an absolute honor to be on a panel with Danica and Mr. Ford. Thank you for the lifelong work towards creating a future for us. A little bit about the perspective that I'm coming to this with. My mother is from Portland, but I was born in and grew up mostly in Minneapolis. When I was born, I lived in the Phillips neighborhood, just a block away from the Little Earth community in Minneapolis that was a center of organizing for the American Indian Movement. And so I saw the service that folks were putting in, the community work and organizing that folks are putting in to keep the community safe. That was done internally. It wasn't done from the state. It wasn't done with state funding. It was done by people in the community putting in work to create a future for the community. Minneapolis has a open school policy. So I did. Later, I grew up in a housing project that was in Cedar Riverside, that was just south of the Phillips neighborhood. And I drove through Phillips and went to a school further south Minneapolis called Clara Barton. At Barton, it was a few blocks from a lake. Minneapolis is a city of lakes. The one that was next to this school was called Lake Calhoun. Lake Calhoun, named after John C. Calhoun, who was a former vice president, Secretary of War, a key administrator in the creation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. At the end of the year, at field days and special occasions, we would get to walk to this lake that is in the neighborhood. And at that time, it wasn't, and this is back in the late 70s, early 80s, at that time, it's not that we didn't know that Calhoun was a slave owner, that he was a key figure in the colonization of the United States and in Indian removal and genocide. It wasn't not known. People had organized to try to respond, to try to change the relationship to this lake and the name. Later, much later, and around was about 12 years ago, there began to be some additional energy picked up to changing the name by the city, by the county, and by the park administration. And from that point, it still took another 9-10 years until, based in this critique of John C. Calhoun as a slave owner, as someone who was intimately connected to genocide, the genocide of through colonization, who had written about his belief that Black people's value only lay in the exploitation of their labor, that was the full expression of what Blackness could be for him. So even with all of that, it still took this ongoing organization that began in the community. Eventually, the state picked it up, changed the name to Bede Makaska, a Dakota name for this lake. But still, there is people in the community who reject this, who reject the name change. It's a reorientation of the name to its pre-colonial name. The reason I bring up this example is because I had a mentor, Asfar Hussain, who, when he speaks about colonization, he speaks of it in these four spheres: land, labor, language, and the body. These four sites of colonization that colonization is a constant regulation and control of these four sites: land, labor, language, and the body. And so that example speaks to ways in which each one of these spheres is constantly being seen as these sites for control. And it's only when we develop an analysis that's able to connect these four pieces, that we're able to develop an analysis that connects local struggles to broader organizing efforts.
So that was Superman performing Miracle. And before that, you were listening to a panel on Black Indigenous Solidarity featuring Mr. Kent Ford, Sky Wilson, and Danica Brown. Next up, Lana Jack reads from her new short memoir, just out in the spring edition of the Oregon Historical Quarterly. We Will Be Here, the story of the Celilo Wyam, is one of mourning, resilience, and resistance. Take it away, Lana.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for hearing me today and letting me share my heart. I am Heyuchpol, the ever-present cooling mist at the falls. My English given name is Lana Jack. My Indian name is as ancient as the land, water, and air my people have coexisted with since the first dawn. We are the Wayampum, the echo of the water off the rocks at the falls people. We belong to the river. Our name is water, and Chivwana is the big river. also known as the Columbia River. It has been our home since time immemorial. We are salmon people. As long as the salmon are here, we will be here. When the salmon die, so will we. We have coexisted with our territories for millennia, interconnected by natural law that governs us and dictates our shared responsibilities to steward and be a voice for all those things created from the first light to we two-legged. We American Indians are often seen by others as savages, living in squalor for somebody else's dollar, violent drunks and addicts in need of law and order. Yet we are resilient in the face of centuries of ongoing genocide. At Wayamtima, also known as Salila Falls, we were as free as the river. At the narrows, where the big river narrowed to 140 feet and cascaded a 20-foot drop, the salmon were so huge and so plentiful that Salila was known as the great trade center of the Northwest and beyond. At Salila Falls, we built wooden scaffolds tied off with horsehair rope. We fished with dip nets. We never knew lack. On the big river and its many tributaries, we thrived on the abundance not only of but steelhead, sturgeon, smelt, eel, and trout. The sturgeon could pull a fully loaded boat for miles. We caught trout where Google's data center is today. We were all about subsistence. For us, wealth was about how much you could give away. The falls were iconic. It was inconceivable that they could ever be silenced. In 1855, the United States signed treaties with multiple Columbia River bands of Indians, the YM included. That promised us the right to fish, hunt, and gather food at our usual and accustomed places. The Middle Oregon Treaty of 1855 was signed by Stockettlie on behalf of the Wampum, referred to in the treaty as the Lower Deschutes. Salila Falls was coveted by white settlers. They coveted the land, the salmon, the beavers, and the trees. Capricious new treaties were written to restrict us. The Treaty of the Middle Oregon, ratified in 1865, required any Indian to have a written permit to leave the reservation and fish, hunt, and harvest food from the land and the waters. The main staple of the survival of the Salila YM were criminalized. Although the Salila YM negotiated the Middle Oregon Treaty of 1855, we were not federally recognized, despite many lawsuits and much legislation attempting to bring honor to the treaty. We are still waiting for fulfillment of broken promises. Today, we aren't even on the map. We aren't even remembered. Our land has been parceled away. Stockettlie, who signed the 1855 treaty, was succeeded by his nephew, Chief Tommy Thompson, who was born the year of the treaty, of the signing of the treaty, and became the great fish chief at the age of 19. He was highly revered and honored for his, when the Bonneville Dam was planned in the 1930s, he knew our fate and that of the salmon. After the dam was built, the loss of return salmon was unprecedented. Chief Tommy Thompson lived to be 103. After the Dalles Dam flooded Wyam in 1957, the state of Oregon put him in a nursing home, parading him around town, displaying him as a prisoner of war for children of all ages to stare at. Tommy died in 1959. On March 10, 1957, the water of the Columbia River rose up and flooded the falls in a few short hours, burying our way of life, our primary food source, and our inherent sovereignty. That was the beginning of the dismantling of our remaining Salalah Wyam people after war and pox. As the rising water silenced the falls, our matriarchs dressed in black, in mourning black, cried for days and nights. The violence of the flooding of the falls has been so overbearing for the people. We did not consent to the flooding of the falls or the stealing of our ancient sacred sites, and we protested the removal of the bones of our ancestors. We have been in perpetual mourning, each generation losing the battle.
Indigenous people, shine your light, we are equal. I remember the days when our prayers were illegal. I remember the days when being Indian was lethal. Yeah, we had a rough past, but get ready for the sequel.
That was Lila Johnson singing All Nations Rise, and now we return to Lanajack.
Our Indian names connect us to the land we are from. My granduncle Moses P. Shaway told me, no matter where you go, your name will bring you home. Back here, you are Wyam. My mom was born at the falls, her mother and her mother's too. I was born into this intergenerational trauma. I am one of only a handful of Salalah Wyam left who can trace our lineage via documentation, and yes, blood quantum, our great mark of pedigree. American Indian people are dying out this way after centuries of oppression and genocide. While there are 574 federally recognized tribes in the United States and more than 400 tribes that are not recognized by the federal government, many other tribes are fully extinct, and others like ourselves are at the tipping point of going extinct. I'm not telling you my story lightly. I'm not sharing this for greed or for fame. This is not easy for me. To talk about the pain and suffering we have experienced as Salalah Wyam. All due respect to my elders with their own stories. I will pay for this. There are people who are criticized and even retaliate. I am not safe in my own home for speaking out. There is a price to pay. But we are desperate to thrive. And we deserve justice. I don't want pity. I want action. One of the ways the oppressors ensure we have no power is by criminalizing our sacred foods, preventing us from fishing and hunting and gathering in our usual and accustomed territories. The Salalah Wyam are river people. We come from the river. Our brothers and sisters are the salmon, the beaver, the roots, the berries that grow here, all nourished by the land and water. Most importantly, the water. My dad raised us, me and my siblings, to have no fear on the water. Even at night, we fished 24/7. Summer days, we lived on the river and in the trees at the park. They were a part of us, our friends. Our daddy was a great fisherman from Alaska to the Columbia River and everywhere in between. We fished hard with our mom and dad and our uncles. There were only two boys, Leon and Lonnie, and four of us girls, Lila, Leah, Joanne, and me. Our dad's crew was all girls most of the time, all spaghetti straps, tube tops, and Daisy Dukes, styling in our fish boots. We hung and cleaned, patched nets, and when we weren't running them or guarding them. Because we lost our tribal fishing and hunting rights and sites, it was illegal for the Salila YM people to fish. And it remains illegal. The state game warden called my dad, the elusive Percy Jack. The warden said they could never catch him with fish and could never find him when they tried. He had multiple close calls with the authority when I was growing up. There were six of us kids, our parents, in one tiny two-bedroom house. So I made my room in the closet. Under my bed was a manhole. One morning, I woke up to my dad's panicked voice yelling, "Get up, get up, get up." He threw my bed aside and he and my mom threw gunny sacks full of fish into the hole along with a net covered in fish scales. He quickly changed and scrubbed off what mud he could, tossing his scaly clothing down with the fish. Soon, the state game wardens came knocking at the door saying, "We saw you, Percy Jack." There I was, pretending to be asleep, guarding the manhole and our livelihood.
We don't have to hide anymore, 'cause now's the time. All nations rise. Rise up, 'cause now's your time. We don't have to hide anymore, 'cause now's the time.
Again, that was Lila Johnson singing All Nations Rise. And before that, we heard Lana Jack reading from her new short memoir. This is Nimi Pumul, Julian Ankeny. Oh! And I've been your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour, which has featured audio excerpts from an April conference on Washington State University Social Justice Conference. Today's show was co-produced and edited by Patricia Kohlberg and Desiree Helligers. We're going to play out with the AIM song. Until next time, this has been Nimi Pumul, Julian Ankeny.